You're listening to America's Most Challenging Issue, where Baha'iTeachings.org interviews community builders across the nation who are inspired by the Baha'i vision of the oneness of humankind. Join us as we explore their work, bringing about racial unity and establishing a more just and equitable society. I'm your host, Masoud Olufani. My servants, could ye apprehend with what wonders of my munificence and bounty I have willed to entrust your souls? You would, of a truth, rid yourselves of attachment to all created things, and would gain a true knowledge of your own selves, a knowledge which is the same as the comprehension of mine own being. From the Baha'i Writings. My guest today is many things, a teacher, and a student, a counselor, and a seeker of counsel, a speaker, and a listener, a leader, and a servant, a wife, and mother. Imasumak Marilyn Davis is a descendant of the Quechua people of Bolivia, a community of some 1.6 million individuals, and of British-Irish immigrants to early America. She represents the confluence of distinct cultural streams brought together to form a river of transgenerational, transnational literacies, and accumulated ways of knowing. She is a trained clinical psychologist, a writer, podcast host, an educational consultant, and intuitive healer. She is an outreach coordinator at Bosch Baha'i School in Santa Cruz, California. And she also serves as a member of the National Race Amity Task Force, a Baha'i-inspired entity created to learn how the Institute process, a set of community-building activities initiated by the Baha'i world community, can help address the challenges of racial prejudice. And in addition to that, she has one of the most soothing velvet tone voices in the podcast universe. Imasumak, welcome to America's Most Challenging Issue.
Thank you, Masoud.
You know, there are so many things I want to speak with you about, Ima, and, you know, but I wanted to begin with your name. I mean, I think you have a beautiful name. Mm-hmm. I think it flows really beautifully off the tongue, but I know there's much more to it than just, you know, the phonetic quality of the name. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to know if you could tell me about your name.
Yeah, that's a great place to start. Mm-hmm. So, as you mentioned, my father is from the Quechua people, and he says that Quechua is a emotional language. So he said it's very hard to translate what certain meanings are between phrases in Quechua into English. So he tells a story, and so I'll tell a story. He says that Imasumak comes from the phrase Imasumakanki. And so Imasumakanki is an expression of joy. He said what it means is that when you see a newborn baby for the first time, you say Imasumakanki. When you see the sun rise, you say Imasumakanki, right? He says it means to express you are the best, you are the most beautiful, the most perfect. And so according to my father, when I was born, before I was born, he was an immigrant to this country. He married my mother, and he thought, I need to do things what he considered the American way. And so he decided to name me before I was born. That's not common in our tradition. You name after because you want to kind of be with the spirit of the child. And so he named me after my grandmother on my mother's side of the family, which is Sally. And my middle name was Angelica, because you can say it in English and Spanish, Angelica Angelica. And so originally my name was supposed to be Sally Angelica. And my father says that when I was born, the first thing he said was Imasumakanki. And then he said, that's it, that's your name, Imasumak. And he said he went running to the registrar and said, change your name. And so my name is Imasumak, and then my middle name is Angelica. And I'm very grateful.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's really wonderful. You know, it's such a kind of like a there's this sense of ancestry that I feel in your name, mm-hmm. you know, that speaks so much about your cultural heritage, which I think is quite beautiful, mm-hmm. Which, you know, even deepens the name already sounds beautiful, but that meaning even deepens it even further than that. It makes it more significant. So thank you for that. It's really wonderful. Mm-hmm. And the Baha'i writings say that racism is one of the most baneful and persistent evils in society. You know, this podcast is called America's Most Challenging Issue, because the Baha'i writings say that racism is the most challenging issue confronting America, right? Mm-hmm. One of the ideas that you speak about so eloquently in relation to the healing work that you do is this concept of intergenerational trauma, right? Mm-hmm. Carried through the DNA. That what we do today actually has, you know, the capacity in some sense to impact seven generations, right?
Right.
Now, this is not a new concept among indigenous communities, but, you know, Western science has finally caught up. They've acknowledged this truth, most notably through epigenetics, which is a branch of scientific inquiry that, you know, examines heritage alterations in the blood. And when we talk about the issue of racism, we are speaking about a kind of perversion of human perception, right? And how we see others. And that perversion shapes public policy, notions of empathy and community. And I was wondering if you can talk about how the trauma associated with racism affects multiple generations, both of the perpetuators and the victims, and also how our quest for healing can serve to disrupt that cycle.
Yeah, it's such a great question, and it's such a powerful place of exploration. I also appreciate that you acknowledge that many traditions already understood this and carry this understanding. And it's wonderful that we have now a balance also with Western society beginning to kind of explore this area. I think most notably where it initially shows up is in patterns of behavior. Mm. You know, the way that we speak, the words that we choose, and often we choose words that we have at our and within our reach. So if I don't have the language of compassion, if I don't have the language of generosity, if I don't have a language of abundance, I can't speak in that way, right? And so what I mean by that is that if the language I know is a language that says, yes, no, do this, don't do that, why are you doing this, stop doing that, then that's the language that I'll speak because that's all I have access to, right? And so then And language is a very powerful shaper of not only behavior, but also belief systems. And so then the language that we use with each other, and most importantly with our children, then shapes not only their behavior, right? We limit, we stop, we minimize, right? And then also shapes belief systems. The area that I've explored this in great detail is in emotion. Right. So I feel that in emotion, we have a very poor understanding. I think we're moving into a greater understanding, but we don't really understand how emotions move like energy. When language tries to limit an emotion, right? Don't cry. Why are you doing that? Why are you afraid? Mm-hmm. Right. Like these kind of like tough and stopping kind of words, then it creates a conflict because inside of me, I'm feeling certain things, right? As a child, I feel afraid. I feel sad, but I'm being told no, right? And so now I either have to believe the voice on the outside, which is the adults that are in my care, I'm in their care, or I have to, you know, negate what I'm feeling inside. And most often children will negate what they're feeling inside because they have to trust the adults around them. They're the ones that will ensure their survival. It's almost their first relationship with a creator in a sense, because that's all they know, right? And so then children will then begin to internalize something's wrong with me. Why am I feeling this way? I'm not supposed to feel this way. Why am I doing this? I'm not supposed to be doing this, right? And so that's what I call, it creates a process of creating false belief systems, right? That they hold within themselves, that something is wrong with them and not with, that the world outside is okay. Because the adults outside have said it's okay. But what I'm feeling is in conflict with that. So then that must be what's the problem. Right. And then this kind of gets confounded throughout that journey of childhood. And so, And so I think now when you think in a historical aspect, right, these patterns then were set, you know, very like, you know, a long time ago through colonization, right? You know, so colonization said, no, you know, not that, you know, you're never going to reach this status of whatever is okay or good, right? And so then it's stop. You know, not okay. What's wrong with you? Right. You know, and so then, and these are the things that get passed down to today. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think the effort that it takes to learn about your inner landscape, mm-hmm. you know, taking time to listen to your emotions, learn about them, right? We're really mm-hmm. afraid of them. We're afraid of our pain. We're afraid of our fear. Mm-hmm. We're afraid of our anger. And the Baha'i writings do such a wonderful job of guiding us through this, right? Mm-hmm. You know, they help us understand that, you know, it's just a movement. It's a movement of energy, right? And it's a movement of energy from our lower nature to our higher nature, right? Mm-hmm. And so if we can learn to move energy from our lower nature, right? Which is, when I say lower nature, that would be something like where I am holding on to fear because I'm afraid that it's true, right? That fear is true, that I really am, I'm not good enough, that I really won't be okay, that the world really is a bad place, right? So I'm going to hold on to that. Whereas if I can begin to release that, right, and just let fear move, it can move to its higher energy, which is faith. That I really am amazing, that I really do have something to contribute, that the creator did create a perfect creation, right? Then that movement goes to truth. And Baha'u'llah calls those the emotions of the kingdom, right? And I just love that phrase, you know, the emotions of the kingdom, because it's like, that's where we're moving to. But of course that's a process and it's a process that is daily, right? It's not like I've arrived, I'm at the emotions of the kingdom. You know, it's a movement to that space. And so I think the more that we can learn about how to apply the teachings of these divine revelations, right? Which, you know, Baha'u'llah, as Baha'is we believe, is the most recent. If we can learn to apply these teachings into our life, they help us then make that movement, right? From this lower base energy to a much higher vibration. Mm-hmm. And so when we talk about intergenerational trauma, I think the first place to begin to look is the language that I'm using, because the language that I'm using is going to guide me to the emotional, kind of what's the emotional force behind that language, right? Mm-hmm. And then follow that emotional force down to its belief system. I have learned through the healing process that one of the things that I learned to do with the healer that I worked for myself, and then in turn now I work with others, is really shifting their language to a language of compassion, to a language of abundance. And this language is for themselves, right? Because if I don't know how to be compassionate with myself, it's very difficult to be compassionate with somebody else. But as I learn to be compassionate with Ima, then I learned to be compassionate with everyone else, right? And so my language began to shift as a parent, right? It became more gentle. I took more time. You know, mistakes and accidents were okay. You know, it just became softer. And that process then began to spill out over to everyone, right? So I take more time with my husband, with my parents, right? You know, it's a really wonderful shift that happens. So when you ask about intergenerational trauma, I also think that you can do this work in the name of your ancestors, right? And that's what I chose to do. I did this work in the name of my grandmothers because I felt that by doing that, by making that movement and that effort, they too, Baha'u'llah says that when you do something in the name of someone who is in the spirit world, they advance also spiritually. And so I did my healing work in their name, that they would also advance spiritually. And so that and also then connects us to our ancestors, right? Who had to go through, you know, the oppression of colonization when it was, you know, not as systemic as it is now. I mean, it's very systemic now, and it was systemic then too, but it was also very like outwardly, you could see it outwardly as well, right? And so now the healing work that we do today, we can honor that effort and that sacrifice of our ancestors of survival to the work that we do when we try to root out these false belief systems and get to know the truth of who we are.
I love that. I reminds me of a story. I was in Savannah, Georgia, which is about 5 hours outside of Atlanta, Georgia, where I live. Mm-hmm. And it's right on the coast. And, you know, the Georgia Sea Islands and also the South Carolina Sea Islands are home to the Gullah Geechee community, mm-hmm. which are the descendants of enslaved Africans who were able to maintain a strongly kind of African-based cultural tradition because of their isolation from the mainland. Mm-hmm. So I was speaking to an elder of the Gullah Geechee, and we were having a dialogue in my studio space. And as we were talking, he was talking about his parents, and then this word that he, this phrase of low world gods came up. Mm. And I said, that is a really interesting phrase. What do you mean by that? And he said, well, low world gods is what we call our parents because they are, in terms of when you're a child, they handle everything that you need, your parents handle. So to the child, that is your God in a sense, but they are the low world God. They're not the greater world God. And you have to learn that. Mm-hmm. So I just thought that was, you were talking about ancestry, right? Mm-hmm. And about, I mean, we talk about generational trauma and how things are passed on from generation to generation, that notion of, and you actually brought up this concept in your response about parents kind of being like gods. And it just reminded me of that conversation. Really powerful.
If I just mentioned something on that, because it was, you know, this learning that came through working with others was really powerful in the realization that is our first experience with the Creator. And that also can shape our relationship with the Creator, right? Mm-hmm. And so if that relationship is one in that is limiting, right, where we feel like, oh no, you know, or filled with guilt, which, you know, you know, guilt and a healthy guilt, right? Like, oh, I hurt somebody, ouch, I need to not do that, right? It's okay. But a guilt that says you're not okay turns into shame, right? So shame is not a, shame is a, comes from colonization, right? Where it's, you're not good enough, you're not, you know, you'd never be okay. Something's wrong with you. You're the problem, right? Which we know is not true, right? And Baha'u'llah tells us that we're noble beings. And so we know that we're not, like, at our core, not the problem. Doesn't mean I don't have things to work on. I do, always, right? So if my experience with that first Creator is one that is filled with shame, that is limiting, then what I'm in danger of is thinking that the Creator, the one that created this incredible universe that we get to participate in, is also that thing, right? It's also limiting, it's also filled with shame. And and that can be such a challenge, because then we place man-made experiences on who this divine being, this divine force is, right? And that's what I find the healing process so powerful, because as you walk through that and you realize, no, your parents were just wonderful individuals who were, you know, contributing with everything that they had, and sometimes they didn't have what you needed. Then you become much more forgiving and more compassionate, and you realize, oh, but the Creator has everything, because look at the mountains, how amazing they are. Look at the ocean. We haven't even discovered the end of the ocean, right? The bottom of the ocean. So whoever created that also created me. That's amazing. That I have to have, you know, some kind of amazingness to me. So, you know, it's that posture that shifts from our parents.
That's such a powerful insight, because I think what has to happen in terms of maturing that relationship of understanding one's relationship to God, large G, right, as opposed to one's relationship to God, small G, which, you know, your parents in certain cultural traditions, is that you almost have to crack the shell of your parents' humanity. You have to see them as three-dimensional human beings who had wonderful things that they did and maybe some problematic things. And it makes you more compassionate. It makes you more understanding. It makes you more patient with them and also with yourself. And as you said, you and from that experience, from that realization, that opens you to the majesty, the grandeur of the greater God, which is so beautiful. It's a wonderful, wonderful thought. Wow. Well, moving on, I wanted to talk a little bit about this amazing website that you do, that you have, which is called the Limitless Learning Lab. Right. And you have this this concept that I thought was really intriguing for me, and it's called purposeful disruption. And, you know, and you describe it as being, you say, which is the use of authentic stressor points that stretch longstanding norms to allow divergent opportunities with nuggets of truth to surface. And this is such a powerful statement, particularly in how it relates to the work of growth through the dismantling of false dichotomies, right? And as a descendant of an indigenous community and a colonizing community, you represent, in some sense, these historic oppositional forces, right? The legacy of the oppressed and also of the oppressor. And I'm wondering how you have worked to integrate these two realities and how that process has served you in the tremendous work that you do.
That's such a great question. I want to know your process of coming up with these questions. Yeah, you know, I do a lot of writing, and I call in my writing, I call that living in the crash. And I do writing for healing, meaning that I journal to help me process through experiences that I'm having. And then I also do writing in multiple ways, right? I mean, in poetry and narratives and articles. But one of the things that came out was this idea of these two forces that I grew up with. And these forces, of course, were represented through my parents, but in reality, it was really the cultures that they came from. And and these two forces really, when they meet, because they do not understand each other, because they do not, because they move rhythmically in very different ways, and they don't move, when they move rhythmically in different ways, if they don't move with humility, right, then they can't learn from each other. Then instead what happens is they crash into each other. And so a lot of my experience was that, right, culturally. So on a wider culture, every time that I participated in either one, there was always confusion as to what to do with me, right? Because they weren't quite sure. They hadn't experienced someone like me in their community because I was mixed, right? I was mixed with a different culture that, for one, brought a great deal of pain and a great deal and a constant reminder of the not good enough. And then for the other, a great deal of shame, right? You know, and a great deal of, I consider the weight of sadness from that historical piece of being the oppressor. And so when you walk in the middle of that, you know, it's very difficult to choose a side because these forces are too strong. And so when forces are strong like that and you can't choose sides, then what you have to learn to do is you have to learn to live in the middle. And when you live in the middle, it requires a great deal of, you have to pull from another source, right? It can't, because yours is too limiting. And so, so this other source, for me has been going to divine revelations. And it's all, you know, Baha'u'llah says that all divine revelations are one long continuous revelation throughout history, right? Which is really wonderful. So that means that we have access to the Buddha and his teachings, right? It means that we have access to Jesus Christ and his teachings, right? And so we're really grateful for that because they're so rich. Of course, we know that the spiritual teachings stay the same, right? It's really only the social teachings that shift and change. And so it's those spiritual teachings then you gravitate to and you look to them and you ask, what is it asking me to do? How is it asking me to live? Right. And then you try to reflect that. Right. And you try to how does my behavior change according to what Baha'u'llah's revelations say? How does my posture, and posture is a word I use a lot. And sometimes, you know, we think of posture in terms of people's back, right? Like if they're standing straight, which is a great way to think about it. But posture is also just kind of the energy you carry when you walk into a room. What is your posture when you're walking into a room, right? And I feel that when it comes to these two forces that are, you know, crashing in the middle, I think the most important posture is humility, because neither side understands the level of devastation and the level of pain that gets created through the terms you use, being a colonizer and being colonized, right? The oppressor and being the oppressed. Because the reality is that underneath that, what Baha'u'llah calls, you know, the bane of prejudice, underneath that mantle of racism, everybody is oppressed. Everybody loses, right? And so when you walk in the middle of that, if you walk with humility, right, with a great deal of with a desire to learn, right, then you walk into those spaces and the question is, tell me more, right? I want to hear more. I want to understand more and help them open up that experience. And so it's been learning to do that. It's been learning to walk in with that kind of posture, with that desire to learn and to question.
You know, it's so interesting because I think oftentimes what you're talking about, it seems to me, is this kind of three-dimensionality of the legacy of racism, right? That it has an impact on both groups. And, you know, obviously, for most of our energy is expended on understanding how it has impacted the victims. But in reality, what has the victimizer given up? What part of themselves, what essential aspect of themselves have they forfeited in that bargain, you know, in that Faustian bargain, if you will, for power, for control, for dominance? And they have given up something very essential about themselves. It actually takes away from their humanity in a way, and that has to be reclaimed. And so that legacy, you know, it's one of the things that I always, when I talk to people about history, and we talk about the history that through the prism of blackness a lot of times when I'm speaking to the public, and I say, but this is not just black history, this is all of our collective history. So the ownership of that history, of these experiences of racism, not just for the victimizer, but also for those who were the victims, for everybody's involved in that process. So thank you so much for framing that way. It's really wonderful.
And just if I can also mention, when you said this, it also made me think of something that has also come up in healing work. I work with a diversity of people, and one group that I always am amazed at, you know, who walks in comes. There's been a consistent stream of people that come in from primarily a very I would say economically stable and even wealthy community, and primarily it would be the white women of that community that seek to work and understand, which is really wonderful. And one of the things that came out when we talk about this history of racism was, you know, this idea of kind of just feeling guilty that they have something that they think this other community doesn't have. And so when you mentioned this, it made me think of the lens in which we view the world, right? Mm-hmm. If the lens in which we view the world is a material lens, then that is true, right? Then it's true that there's one community that has something that everybody else doesn't have, right? Mm-hmm. But when you shift that lens and you instead use the lens that the divine revelations give us, right, which is a spiritual lens, in actuality, those other communities are vastly wealthy, right? I mean, the level of faith it takes to walk through 400 years of systematic oppression, right? And still kind of be intact as a people, right? You know, and I say that with a little bit of humor, that, you know, kindly be intact, because actually very intact, right? And these communities are incredible communities, walking with an incredible amount of power and grace and vision. And so when you look at it through that lens, actually those communities are really wealthy, right? And so we want to make sure that we always recognize which lens are we looking at it through. It does not mean, and this is where the Baha'i community is really learning about not walking with dichotomies, right? So this is not an either or. It doesn't mean, oh, well, so then you're spiritually wealthy, so we don't have to worry about it, right? No, no, we of course we address material inequality, right? Absolutely. So it's not an either or. It is, however, always asking yourself, what lens am I looking through? Because if I'm looking through a spiritual lens, then I recognize, oh, in actuality, there's a lot to learn about how to withstand, how to walk forward, how to be strong, right? How to have faith, right? Which is something everybody struggles with. I think that is key.
Yeah, that's so wonderful because, you know, I've been really interested in, you know, the Universal House of Justice, the supreme governing body of the Baha'i World Faith, has this phrase called constructive resilience, right? And it was utilized in reference, I believe it was a letter that came out in the early 2000s around September. And it was utilized to speak about the way that the beleaguered Baha'i community in Iran is addressing the inequalities, the marginalization, the religious prejudice that is exerted against them by the government, right? And I started thinking about these models of constructive resilience and how through time, communities that have been besieged, that have been oppressed, that have been maligned, that have been, gone through unimaginable levels of suffering, have found creative, constructive ways to respond to those experiences that kept their communities intact, that kept them moving forward through unimaginable pain. So that's so true. And I just thank you for reminding yourself, all of us collectively, of that reality. That's wonderful. Wow. Thank you so much. Well, Ima, we're in a very challenging moment in human evolution. We've kind of talked about this just a little bit, but, you know, all of the institutional pillars that mankind has previously relied on, they seem to be ineffective in meeting the challenges confronting us, right? Humanity is increasingly engulfed by a sea of despair and hopelessness, it seems. And the Baha'i writings describe this destructive process occurring simultaneously with the constructive process of building a new civilization based on the Baha'i revelation, right? And this phenomenon is often referred to in terms of a duality of crisis and victory. And I'm wondering, as you look around as an inheritor of the spiritual literacies of your indigenous ancestry and as a Baha'i, mm-hmm. where do you find hope for the future?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that you mentioned was that we're trying, we're learning in the Baha'i community, we're learning how to apply, this divine revelation to help us with, kind of this ill that is facing humanity, right? And so, and I think that application of the divine teachings, which again, when I think of the divine revelations, I always remember that it has a long tail, right? Because there's revelations that go back, we know to the time of Abraham, but we've also been told before, right? And so this line of revelation is very, very long. And so when I think about this application of the divine teachings, I think of transformation. And when I think about transformation, I begin to reflect on what does transformation look like? There's a wonderful quote that I in my office, I keep it at the top of my whiteboard, and I have it on my phone because it's a reminder for me. And it comes from Baha'u'llah. And Baha'u'llah says, "It's not the object of every divine revelation to effect a transformation in the whole character of mankind, an effect that will transform its inner and outer conditions." Right. And so that's the goal. That's the purpose of every divine revelation. And so the question that I always ask myself is, if I'm not transforming, then am I allowing this revelation to do what it came to do? Because either I transform, or Baha'u'llah has some interesting ideas, but that's really all they are. Right. And so because I believe it's a divine revelation, then the question is, what does it look like when I apply it to my life? What does it look like when I allow it to transform? And when you look at transformation, you can look at it from many angles. I've had this conversation with a lot of friends, and some people say, do you know what it looks like when a worm transforms into a into a butterfly, right? They're like, it's really ugly. Like in the cocoon, it comes apart, right? You know, and I thought, oh, that's such a great way of thinking of transformation, right? It is ugly. It is a falling apart. It is it's messy, right? The other thing recently a friend told me is that in that transformation process of that, and I don't know, somebody scientific is going to get real upset that I called it a worm, but caterpillar, but in the process of that little caterpillar shifting over into a butterfly, this friend said to me that it's very focused on the self. Right? And I was like, whoa, that's powerful, right? And it's not focused on the self in terms of aggrandizement. Of course not, because if you look in the cocoon, it wouldn't want anyone to see what's going on inside there. It's so messy, right? But it's focused on the self in terms of dismantling, right? What is no longer going to serve me? What is not going to allow me to fly? I need to discard those parts, right? And that discarding can be challenging because sometimes we're a little attached to those parts, right? I don't want to really let go of that. And then it's also, what do I need to acquire? What do I need to take in, right? What needs to become part of my new being, right? And when you think about a butterfly, you think about the lightness that it has. What's going to allow me to be light, right? So that I can elevate. And so that it's such a wonderful metaphor for, I think, what we're all going through right now. Transformation is ugly, right? It can look messy, right? But it's actually really beautiful, right? There's actually a movement of light that is happening through all of us. And so when I remember that that's what transformation is, right? Then I can remember, oh, it's okay. This is part of that process, right? And the place that I always go to when I begin to lose hope, when I begin to feel despair, when I begin to feel it's overwhelming, because it does feel overwhelming. It does feel like too much. It does feel like I can't do this anymore, right? Is then I go to those divine teachings and I read them, and then they remind me. And they're written in a language that is so beautiful and uplifting and nourishing. And then you say, oh, okay, that's right. This is part of a process, right? This is part of that long promise that was prophesied by Jesus Christ, that the kingdom of God will be on earth, right? But it's a transformative process. And just like the caterpillar doesn't just tomorrow become the butterfly, you know, we too, right, are going through this movement. Every time I struggle with this movement, whether my own internally or whether with somebody else, right? The thing that I always ask myself is, do I love them? Am I in love yet? Because if I'm not in love yet, it's not their job to make me fall in love. It's my job to fall in love, right? And in the Baha'i community, we have this wonderful tool. It's just a tool of consultation. Right. And Abdu'l-Baha is the son of Baha'u'llah. And he was when Baha'u'llah passed away, he said he's the only one that can interpret the writings. Right. And so we call him the center of the covenant. And so Abdu'l-Baha said that when we enter into consultation, the first absolute necessity, right, the quality that you have to walk in with is absolute love for every single person, right, that you're going to consult with. It feels like a tall order, but then the question is, it doesn't mean that, oh, I don't love you guys yet, I can't consult, I have to wait until I love you. No, I fall in love with you through the process, right? The caterpillar can't say, oh, I'm not a butterfly yet, you're gonna have to wait until I get my wings. No, it's a process, right? And so it's showing up for consultation. It's showing up to the conversation around race amity. It's looking at institutionalized racism and saying, what is my part to play? It's showing up in those things. That is the growth process. That's the transformation process. We can't wait on the side and say, when you guys are ready, then I'll join. Because we learn collectively. We learn in the application of. We learn together. And for me, the essential ingredient is love. Right. I mean, for Ima, if Ima's not in love, then Ima needs to figure it out. Everyone else is doing fine. Everyone else is having a great day. Everyone else is doing wonderful. I'm the one that needs to figure out how I need to fall in love. Right. And that keeps me really focused on that on looking at myself in terms of my posture, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. otherwise, mm-hmm. I can find a whole lot of people that I think are a mess and a half, right? I can say, mm-hmm. you need help, you need help, you need help. But that's not going to move us forward. That's not going to accomplish mm-hmm. Transformation, because I can't transform them. I can only transform me. But then in the mm-hmm. process of me transforming, you also get affected, right? Which is mm-hmm. really wonderful. Mm-hmm. And when you transform, I also get affected. And I'm so grateful mm-hmm. for that.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Wow. Wow. So focusing on self, on my own peculiarities, the things that I need to address with myself, and that in and of itself, creating ripples in the spiritual world and if has impacts on people's lives, you know, yeah. That's so interesting, because so often we do focus on the other. Our society, you know, kind of inculcates that within us, right? On a daily basis, mm-hmm. you know, pointing out people's faults, but really, you know, as the Baha'i Faith says, to bring thyself to account each day, yes. to really look at my actions, what I've done, how they've impacted my mm-hmm. spiritual state, and how they've impacted others, and then to make adjustments, you know, as going forward day to day, improving constantly.
A thought on what you just said right now, because I think it's so important, is, you know, our society does focus on the faults of others. It also focuses on who got it right. Right. Mm, and so then when we think, oh, they got it right, what does that mean? That means I got it wrong. Right. And so that creates this dichotomy of right and wrong. And and when you were, you know, in this healing work, I began this healing work at 15. And of course, looking at the divine revelations, they all divine revelations say be selfless. Right. Mm. And so then you're like, what do I do? Do I look at myself? Do I not look at myself? Do I, you know, then it said, be forgetful of self. How do I forget myself? Mm-hmm. Right. So there's like this like struggle. And, mm-hmm. and in the work that I've done, and in this walk that I've had, what I find is the focusing on the self is the focusing on, rooting out, all those, what in the secular world I would call, false beliefs. Right. But what Baha'u'llah calls the prejudices, right, that are in our heart. And so rooting out, you know, these things that are within me, so that I can make more room for divine revelation to settle into my body. Right. And to settle into myself. And when I can do that work, what I found through, and this was all through walking, right? I mean, I had no idea what was going to come out at the end of it. And there is no end, right? Because we're still in transformation. Mm-hmm. What I found as I've been walking through this is that the more that I fall in love with the Creator's creation, right, which is this creation that He made that is called Imasumak, the more that I fall in love with that, the less important she becomes. Because when I realize, oh, wow, this creation is amazing. Oh my gosh, that means all the other creations are amazing too. And I become instantly much more interested in that, right? Because I've spent time with this creation. I recognize the gifts that this creation has to offer the world. My curiosity now shifts. And I think that's where selflessness comes in. It's not a self-abnegation. It's a movement of love that you recognize the beauty of the creation within you, right? Baha'u'llah has this beautiful hidden word, and hidden words are these, you know, just these special writings that really help us like reflect on the essence of who we are. And he says, turn thy sight unto thyself and find me standing mighty strong and powerful within thee, right? And so, you know, that's who we are, right? And he even says, turn thy sight unto thyself, right? Because you want to get to know your true nature, your true inner reality, so that then you can release it. Because then it becomes unimportant, because you recognize that everybody else has this beauty too. And now you're just moving with others because you're much more interested in the movement rather than, you know, is Ima in the front? Is Ima getting, you know, the focus, right? It's really wonderful. You know, there's so many years spent on trying to recover my voice that came from what, we talked about historical oppression and its effects on generations today. And for me, a big part of that historical oppression for me was the silencing of my voice, right? Be quiet, don't speak, let elders speak first. And I just recently wrote about this because when those ideas are brought in as values, they're beautiful, right? You know, to allow elders to speak first, to be gentle, is wonderful. But when they're used as a weapon to control, to minimize, then it becomes oppressive, right? And then your voice gets silenced, and the essence of who you are isn't allowed to be flourished, to express. And so for me, a big part of that was recovering that, right? Well, when I recovered that, then I was able to, you know, in the process of recovering that, I mean, of course it was beautiful, the discovery of it, but then as I discovered more and more, I was able to release it. It wasn't necessary to keep saying, listen to me, listen to me. It was okay. Why? Because I was already heard. Who heard me? Me. Right? I mean, the creator heard me a long time ago. That's good enough. Now I'm really interested in what you have to say.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about, you talked about the voice, and since you have recovered your voice, you know, I know that, you know, one of the, among your prodigious talents is poetry.
Yes.
And I was hoping that, you know, before we go, because we're just about out of time, if you could share a poem.
That would be lovely. Imasumakanki. You are Quechua Amankaya, from the Andes of Caipacha. Mi lengua no sabe cómo hablarte, y mi alma ni sabe cómo tocarte. Pero aquí, entre tu vientre y tu luz, me acomodaré. And with these words, Mama Crucesa settled in the deep, moist fields of muscle where life's force sets. Respira, Imasumakanki, respira. Mama Ohlu, you are. Manco Capac, you are. Your blueprint started among the crevices of the Illimani. Breathe, Imasumakanki, breathe. Upon the tabletops of emerald mountains, among the folds of green valleys, we tilled the land, our blood blue. We resisted tides of aristocracy, we followed love. From the cliffs of Moher, crashing waters alongside the ocean, I called you. Come, take your Imrama, I will find you there. In a quiet storm, you were born, crowned with lace bonnets, songs of forgotten lullabies, lulling you back. Breathe deep, Imasumakanki, breathe deep. Pirate queen, you are. High King Boru, you are. And all of this, we sewed like patchwork, crisscrossing patterns over your heart. Tenderly sowing truths of resistance. A blueprint of oneness, tied with golden strands, sacrifice and love. I am the fingerprint of my ancestors, the last bend of their cries, the curve in their smiles. I hold the mirror of their dreams. Collectively, we are the fingerprint of humanity. The last imprint of their struggles, the reward of their midnight prayers, ceremonies, lingering melodies. Divided, we are just strands, caught in different hands, waiting for new winds.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you so much, Ima. Thank you for sharing that poem. So much beautiful imagery in there. And more than that, thank you for just the gift of you, of your commitment, your dedication to the work that you do. Thank you for being a warrior woman in this work, right, of eliminating prejudice from the fabric of American society. I just really appreciate you. I want to honor with the work that you do and just encourage you to just keep on keeping on.
So
thank you so much, sister. Thank you so much. Well, you've been listening to America's Most Challenging Issue. I'm your host, Masoud Olufani. And remember, naught but the celestial potency of the Word of God, which ruleth and transcendeth the realities of all things, is capable of harmonizing the divergent thoughts, sentiments, ideas, and convictions of the children of men. From the Baha'i Writings, thank you so much for joining us. Until next time.